It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Almost half the state's school districts are posing referendum questions to voters this year, with a vast majority of those funding requests on the ballot next month.
Lawmakers increased public school funding by about $1 billion in the 2023 to 2025 budget cycle, but many Wisconsin schools are still facing financial hardship.
Districts across the state are grappling with declining enrollments and are being forced to consolidate schools and cut costs. Will this rounding of funding referendums be enough to meet the needs of K through 12 schools?
To learn more, we're joined by Corinne Hess, WPR's education reporter in Milwaukee. Corey, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Morning.
Good morning. So nearly 200 Wisconsin school districts either have asked or will ask a referendum question this year. So how much are districts asking for?
Well, you know, the total amount is about $6 billion across the state. Of course, this ranges from district to district. And when you look at the breakdown with this upcoming election, we've got about, we've got about 140 districts asking for referendums this time. And these are both operating referendums, which is kind of just to keep the school district going. And then also other referendums to do repairs on aging buildings.
And so it's not just about raising revenue limits. You're also seeing these operational needs emerge.
That's right. And you know, when you talk to district administrators, what they're saying is they're just not getting enough money from the state. And, you know, school districts are funded by a mix of taxpayer dollars, state aid, and a small amount by federal aid. And what districts are saying is the state aid money has not kept up over the years. And so what they need is more from the taxpayers.
But lawmakers increased funding for public schools by around $1 billion in this past budget. Why then are so many schools seeing these gaps?
That's right, they did. And the annual funding increase in the last budget was about $325 per student, which did provide some relief. But school districts say that did not catch them up from a freeze that was imposed for several years. And also there's declining enrollments in many districts. So what districts are saying is there's still a gap, and in many cases, they need more money. State Superintendent Jill Underley is calling on legislators to use this nearly $5 billion state surplus to help fund public education. But in the meantime, districts are going to ask taxpayers to approve these referenda.
Corey, you mentioned enrollment declines as having a part in these budget problems many schools are facing. Why is enrollment declining?
Enrollment's declining for several reasons. One reason is some parents are choosing to take their children out of public schools, put them in private schools. But a really big reason for enrollment decline is just the birth rate is down. So there's just fewer kids.
Take us to the Milwaukee suburb of Wauwatosa. It's split on approving school referendums. What are critics of these proposals arguing?
Well, they're just arguing that they don't want to pay more. They don't want their taxes to go up. So in Wauwatosa, they're asking for two referendums. They're asking taxpayers to pay $64.4 million for an operational increase and $60 million to repair aging school buildings. So if both were to pass, that would mean $600 more a year for a homeowner whose house is worth about $300,000, which is about what homes are worth in Wauwatosa on average.
You talked with the superintendent of the district, Damon Means. What was his position on his district's funding requests?
You know, he says that this is needed. He says that the buildings are old. They need to be repaired. He also said that this would give teachers a pay raise, which he wants to do. But he also understands that some people they are going to say no because of the tax increase. He believes that even people who vote no do want to make sure that their kids are getting the services that they want. He says that he's disappointed that the legislature has not stepped up.
Corey, thanks for joining us. Thanks for the update.
Thank you for having me.
Corinne Hess covers education for Wisconsin Public Radio. And now for another perspective, let's bring in Chris Saldana, an assistant professor of K-12 educational leadership and policy analysis at UW-Madison. Chris, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What kinds of choices are districts forced to make if they get funding referendums on a ballot and they fail to pass?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Corey mentioned that there are different kinds of referenda. Referenda that relate to operating revenue really are about making sure that school districts can function. So this means, do they have the adequate number of teachers that they need to make sure that class sizes are effective? Do they have counselors? Do they have nurses? Are they paying their principals enough? Some folks may have heard about things like teacher shortages or principal shortages or folks leaving the profession altogether. All of that relates to the learning environments that school districts can create, which is highly dependent upon the dollars that they have access to. When you think about capital referenda, alternatively, that's more about what Corey mentioned, making sure that buildings are adequate, making sure that the AC works, that the heat works, especially now that we have more extreme weather conditions. It means that bathrooms are fixed, things like that, right? That mm-hmm. folks don't have to put that off in their districts for years and years and years.
Only 60% of school referendums in February and April were approved. That's the lowest level in more than a mm-hmm. decade. As you watch this unfold, do you see voter fatigue setting in on these referendums?
I think that's a great question, too, because part of what is happening here is that the state legislature is making a decision about how to fund public education. You know, there is a world where a more progressive funding system with more state funding provides school districts, especially those that are in communities that don't have a great amount of wealth, have the resources that they need. But policy in Wisconsin is such that it really is up to local voters to decide whether they are going to carry the bill. And you could imagine how that creates disparities across communities in Wisconsin. There are places in rural parts of the state that just don't have the tax base. So they have to tax themselves at higher and higher and higher rates. When you have wealthier parts of the state that where this isn't really an issue, you know, they have such a high tax base, they can raise their property taxes by a little bit and raise a heck of a lot of money.
So when you look at that mix of the taxpayer dollars, the state aid, a bit of the federal aid, according to the Wisconsin Policy Forum, Madison Metropolitan School District and the Wauwatosa District, they're funded more by property taxes than state or federal aid. So what is a district's ideal funding mix?
So that's really highly dependent upon the district. The way that school finance formulas would work ideally is that when you have a district that has a high percentage of kids who are in poverty, a high percentage of kids who have disabilities, a high percentage of kids who are learning English, then the state would provide those additional funds and then also have some funds come in from local taxpayers. I think the idea in the United States has for a long time been that communities kick in some money, but the goal is to make sure that communities are supported when they don't have the wealth locally.
Can we talk a bit about the pandemic relief funds? How important were they in making schools, you know, sure schools had enough money, and are schools shoring up gaps without those federal funds?
Yeah, I think that's another big question that school districts are going to have to face now. The pandemic relief funds were interesting because unlike funds that were provided during the 2008 financial crisis and Great Recession, those funds really were to respond to a health crisis. They were to make sure that kids had access to technology outside of schools if districts didn't already have those resources. And they were also to ensure that school districts could provide additional opportunities to support students to make up for the opportunities that they had lost during the pandemic. You know, those needs are still very much evident. Students are still recovering from the pandemic and have historic traumas that they experienced, whether they lost family members, whether they had different issues at home or just had parents lose jobs or anything like that. You know, those traumas are still existing. And now districts are being asked to still address those traumas that exist and now try to still make up for all of the educational opportunities that was lost, and also try to deal with things like declining enrollment, rising educational costs that correspond to things like inflation, right? So all of these problems are still happening, and federal funds are expiring. So those expire this year. So there is a real question about how districts are going to try to tackle all of these challenges at the same time, which I think really does tie into the referenda questions, because communities are now being asked to support districts through this difficult time.
When you look at these November 5th ballots, some local governments are also proposing competing referenda this November. Mm-hmm. And do these competing referendums then ultimately potentially harm the chance that either of them will pass?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's hard for me to say whether the referenda, the competing referenda will in some ways crowd each other out. But logic would suggest, right, that if I'm being asked to pay more and more and more and more as a local taxpayer, that's a harder and harder question for me to say yes to every single time. And then it really does become a question of well, are we going to support our schools, or are we going to fix our roads, or are we going to make sure that our hospitals are adequate in our community? And I think, again, it raises questions about policy. What are we doing in the state of Wisconsin that it is the burden is placed upon local communities to make these kinds of decisions? And we really don't have any sort of comprehensive state systems to fund these programs that we know are necessary all around the state.
Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Chris Saldana is an assistant professor of K-12 educational leadership and policy analysis at UW-Madison. And earlier, we talked with WPR education reporter Corrine Hess.
Coming up, a Wisconsin group has a new report on the rise of lethal gun violence in our state and offers up solutions.
It's really important for cities that don't currently have an Office of Violence Prevention, look into that, see if it's right for your city, and consider implementing one of those.
Efforts to stop gun deaths, that conversation ahead on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In recent weeks, two devastating hurricanes have pummeled the southern U.S. Scientists say they were made worse by climate change.
Despite the far-ranging effects of the climate crisis, the issue hasn't surged to the forefront of the presidential election. Daniel Kading reports that some Wisconsin voters say it should be top of mind.
In September, a crowd waits in line to see Minnesota Governor Tim Walz at a campaign rally in Superior. Off to the side, Ashland business owner and Democrat Will Pipkin is setting up signs. He rattles off their slogans.
Without a healthy climate, there's no freedom. Another cat lady for democracy.
Pipkin said climate change is one of his top issues, and it's among reasons why he's backing Democratic Vice President Kamala Harris and Walz in the presidential race. WPR asked voters about what issues they want candidates to discuss as part of our America Amplified project. More than a dozen people said climate change is their top concern. Pipkin said he feels Harris and Republican former President Donald Trump didn't say much about the issue during the September presidential debate.
It was glossed over. I'm glad that she pointed toward the things that happened as a part of Build Back Better and the other infrastructure projects. That's good, but it's not nearly enough as to where we need to go.
He's not alone. Democrat Diane Parker of Trigo told WPR she wishes the candidates would weigh in on climate change and severe weather.
I think it's not as much of a hot button issue as some of the other political questions are, the economy and others.
Political expert Mordecai Lee says it's interesting that climate change has been practically invisible in this election, despite two hurricanes hitting Florida in 2 weeks. He's a professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee.
What we're seeing the two candidates talking about as those top of mind issues really don't come anywhere near climate change.
The issue is way down the list of voters' concerns in state and national polls. In a survey last year by Wisconsin's, residents rated it as less of a problem than inflation, gun violence, and health care. Lee says part of the reason it may not be getting much attention is that voters already see Democrats as the pro-environment party. During the presidential debate, Harris touted spending under laws like the Inflation Reduction Act.
Over the last 4 years, we have invested $1 trillion in a clean energy economy, while we have also increased domestic gas production to historic levels.
In stark contrast, Trump said he would revoke any unspent funds under the law, calling it the Green New Scam. At the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee, he pledged to boost oil production.
I will end the devastating inflation crisis immediately, bring down interest rates, and lower the cost of energy. We will drill, baby, drill.
During his presidency, Trump withdrew the nation from the Paris Climate Agreement. The Biden-Harris administration later rejoined the pact aimed at reducing emissions worldwide. Sedona Chin is an assistant professor of life sciences communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She says climate change is clearly not a priority for Trump and adds Harris may not be talking about it as she tries to court voters across the political aisle.
There may be some hesitancy to using an issue that's typically considered a politically polarized issue and a wedge issue and talking about that too much because there's a risk it could alienate some of those moderate Republicans.
In Wisconsin, a survey this year shows voters are split on climate change along party lines. But some conservatives are concerned about it, including Appleton native and Gen Z Republican Benji Backer. The founder of the American Conservation Coalition says the country needs an all-of-the-above energy policy that includes conservative solutions to climate change.
You can lower carbon emissions and pollution in the atmosphere and also grow the economy.
As December draws near, Backer says he's undecided. He says he doesn't subscribe to Harris' beliefs on environmental issues, but Trump's stance on climate change isn't good enough for him. Either way, political experts say the issue is unlikely to pull in Wisconsin's few undecided voters on Election Day. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Firearm deaths in Wisconsin have risen every year since at least 2018. That's according to a new report by the Wisconsin Anti-Violence Effort.
In Milwaukee last month, Mayor Cavalier Johnson made a plea to state and federal lawmakers to help stop the gun violence in his city.
Do something. Show that you care about these kids who are sitting over here, whose neighborhood is shut down because some idiot with a firearm decided to open fire in an apartment building where I presume kids probably live. Right? We need to do something.
That shooting incident left police officers and the suspect injured.
Now we learn about a new report that examines lethal gun violence in our state and compares data to neighboring states. Nick Matuszewski is director of policy and program at the Wisconsin Anti-Violence Effort Educational Fund. Nick, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Your report shows total firearm deaths have risen in Wisconsin every year since at least 2018. What is causing the rise in gun deaths?
Sure. So that's accurate, yes. The most recent data we have is from 2022, but from 2018 to 2022, it is very clear that the rates have been rising. And I think what we can point to, and this has been backed up by other studies as well, is that in that time period, we've seen a higher rate of firearm ownership. And with more firearms in society, we have always seen that that raises the rates of firearm violence. There's this talking point from the NRA and the gun lobby that more guns makes us more safe. But study after study has shown that the opposite is true. So when you have more guns in society, and we saw a huge amount of gun ownership increase, especially during the early years of the pandemic, it's really no surprise that the rates of gun deaths has gone way up.
Can you put 830 Wisconsin residents killed by guns into context? And that's in the year 2022. What does that mean? How do you view that number?
Well, first of all, it's obviously way too high. You know, when we talk about the numbers from this report throughout this conversation, I want to make sure that we realize that we're talking about human lives. You know, we're talking about fathers, brothers, mothers, sisters, children. You know, we're talking about families that have been devastated. For every single life that is lost, you're talking about an entire community that's been forever changed. And what this report doesn't cover as much are firearm injuries that don't result in death. So it's just important to kind of ground that first and foremost. But to the question about how to kind of visualize this, you know, as you said, the rates have gone up each and every year since 2018. And we're talking about almost over 100 people more over that time period per year. So it's obvious, and it should be obvious to most people, that we have a serious issue in this state and in this country. We just need to make sure that we are focused on solutions.
I want to unpack solutions here as well. Your report says the rate of firearm deaths in Wisconsin now outpaces the rate of deaths in car accidents. Mm-hmm. What is the state doing to address firearm deaths? What are you seeing?
Frankly, the state is doing far too little to address firearm deaths. And in fact, an argument can be made that at least for many of the folks in our state legislature, they are trying to put forward bills that would increase the rates of firearm deaths. I'm talking about things like arming more people in public, arming teachers at schools, allowing for firearms to be carried on church grounds that are attached to school campuses, removing other prohibitions on safe carrying of firearms, fighting us tooth and nail on every single proposal that we've put forward. And what we know is that policies like universal background checks are widely supported. Policies like extreme risk laws, also known as red flag laws, are widely supported by Wisconsinites. And we're talking 80% approval for both of those policies. Secure storage, these types of policies are widely supported as well. But for too long, too many of the folks in power, particularly those in the state legislature, have refused to take action on these measures. And as I said, have actually put forward policies that make our state less safe rather than more safe.
You mentioned red flag laws and universal background checks. That some other states have gone ahead with those types of laws. What do you see happening around us in neighboring states?
Sure. I mean, you look at a state like Indiana, which is a conservative state, and yet they were one of the first states to implement red flag laws or extreme risk laws. And we've seen their rates of suicide go down quite a bit. It's important to keep in mind that although these policies are also often talked about in terms of how they would prevent mass shootings, for as tragic and awful and preventable as they are such a small percentage of the actual gun deaths in this country. And the vast majority are suicides. So laws like the extreme risk laws and universal background checks, those are really, really effective at reducing rates of suicide and other types of firearm violence. But suicide is really salient here to this conversation because it's a large percentage of the gun deaths in Wisconsin are from suicide. So what we've seen is that Indiana implemented that policy a few years back and their rates of suicide have decreased. There's a lot of talk about how Illinois and Chicago have high gun firearm violence. But really, when you dig into the data, not only are the rates of firearm violence a lot smaller than people like to portray in the media, it's also the case that most of their firearms come from out of state. Most of their crime firearms are coming from places like Indiana, Iowa, and in fact, Wisconsin.
We're talking about an increase in firearm deaths in Wisconsin with Nick Matuszewski, WAVE Educational Fund Policy and Program Director, and their new report is out. It is called Gun Death in Wisconsin. Nick, we have seen some communities around Wisconsin creating positions for violence interrupters in recent years, and these outreach workers who are trying to mediate conflicts before they escalate into gun violence. Are violence interrupters making an impact?
They absolutely are, not just here, but around the country. Community violence intervention, you know, for the viewers that aren't as familiar with that, is a relatively new policy. And by new, I don't mean brand new, but, you know, within the last few decades has really gained some popularity for good reason. It's a policy that works to meet folks where they're at, you know, to go into communities that have the highest rates of gun violence and to offer opportunities for individuals caught up in cycles of violence to break out of that violence. So, you know, maybe it's educational opportunities, counseling, healthcare, showing them forms of welfare that they're that are accessible to them that they might not know, just giving them the mentorship they need to realize that there is a life outside of violence. Because we know that the vast majority of violence is constrained to a small portion of any given population. So if you can work with those that are most likely to both be the victims of violence, but also often the perpetrators of violence, you can make huge inroads in those communities and really change them for the better. And Wisconsin's kind of on the leading edge with that too. We have more offices of violence prevention in the state of Wisconsin than any other state outside of California.
Wow.
You know, keeping in mind that California has roughly 40 million people, Wisconsin's around 6 million or so. So per capita, that's something that we're really proud of. And yeah, these offices have been shown to work. A lot of the offices here in Wisconsin are newer and are still in the early stages of getting set up, such as in Green Bay and Racine. But I have full faith that their efforts will be incredibly successful. Their leadership has done amazing work already, and we're really looking forward to seeing what they can do going forward.
Nick, earlier this year, when the U.S. Surgeon General declared that gun violence is a public health crisis in America, we talked about that moment with Dr. Megan Schultz. She's an associate professor of pediatrics at the Medical College of Wisconsin. And Schultz said that this issue touches all aspects of our community.
This is not just a policy issue for politicians to worry about. This is not just a medical issue for doctors to worry about. Parents and adults and teachers and business owners need to be talking with, honestly, everyone in the community about guns, but especially children.
How would you suggest we talk with young people, we talk with our kids about the dangers of firearms?
You know, fortunately, we don't have to, you know, figure out these solutions on our own. The White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention, which just recently celebrated its first year anniversary, has done some amazing work alongside the Department of Education and, you know, some of the other federal departments to really put forward really strong guidelines on how to talk to children about firearms, firearm safety, what that looks like, and what it means to be responsible around firearms. And also just, you know, very, you know, it's very worth pointing out, too, that while we will always push for responsible gun ownership, it's also the case that we know that having a firearm makes you less likely to be safe and not more likely. So it's important to tell our children that you know, it's not something that's going to make you safer to be around one. You know, make sure you're staying away from firearms. If you have a friend whose family owns a firearm, you know, you don't play around with it, you know, all these different things. But the Office of Violence Prevention has done a great job. And they've also sent out letters to different schools across the country that schools should be sharing with the parents of their students about how to secure their firearms as safely as possible.
Nick, one more thing about your study. You used federal data, including FBI data. The FBI statistics don't capture all the details about gun violence in America. We know that the data is based on information that's voluntarily submitted by police departments. Is this incomplete picture a problem when trying to find solutions to gun violence across the country and here in Wisconsin?
Absolutely. Absolutely. What we've seen is that researchers have been limited in studies that they can do around gun violence and the solutions. They have been discouraged at the federal level from pursuing holistic pictures and data around this horrible, horrible issue. I'm glad to say, and now this isn't enough, but I am glad to say that the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention announced just a couple weeks ago that they are partnering with the Department of Health and Human Services and others to ensure that going forward, the data is more holistic and it needs to include not just reports that are filed at the scene of a crime, but also in our hospitals and in other medical facilities across the country. And it needs to include not just deaths by firearms, but injuries by firearms. We need to do as much as we can to paint the entire picture so that folks realize just how severe this situation is. So that's one step in the right direction, but really anything we can do to promote the full capability of researchers and statisticians and others to really paint the fullest picture possible on this, we should be doing.
Nick, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
That was Nick Matuszewski, Director of Policy and Program at the Wisconsin Anti-Violence Effort Educational Fund. If you or a loved one is having thoughts of suicide, call or text 988 to reach the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Again, it's three digits, 988.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a look back at the extinct passenger pigeon and a plan that might bring them back to Wisconsin.
They flocked around in these giant flocks of anywhere from 1 billion to 3 billion birds in one flock, and they were noted for blocking out the sun like an eclipse as they flew overhead.
That's up next here on Wisconsin Today from WPR.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. The passenger pigeon roamed the skies until the species was hunted to extinction in the early 1900s.
Now, conservationists are working to find the bird's historic nesting sites across Wisconsin to understand their role in forest ecology and potentially bring the species back.
Ben Novak is lead scientist for Revive and Restore, which is leading the Passenger Pigeon Project, and Steve Applebaum is a senior biologist at the Applied Ecological Institute. Steve, thanks for joining us.
You're so welcome.
And Ben, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
Ben, start us off with the story of the passenger pigeon. As I understand it, the last one went extinct. 1914 was the last passenger pigeon we know about. They were huge. Tell us a little bit about their role in Wisconsin and elsewhere in North America.
Yeah, well, I mean, probably plenty of people in Wisconsin are very familiar with the passenger pigeon, and that's because a man named A.W. Shorger, back in 1955, basically wrote the book on the history of the passenger pigeon. And he was from Wisconsin. He used a lot of historic records from Wisconsin to piece together what we know about passenger pigeons. And basically what made that species so famous was in the early 1800s, before they go extinct in 1914, they were the most abundant bird in North America, likely the most abundant bird on the planet, and they were noted for blocking out the sun like an eclipse as they flew overhead, dropping guano like snow, causing mayhem in the forest. And because they were so abundant and in one spot like that, just like the American bison, and there was large herds, they were easy to go out and kill and trap a whole lot at once. And so they were fed upon by people in the millions. The industrial scale hunting went out to get them for commercial food markets. And in a matter of just a couple decades, they went from 5 billion birds to just a few thousand birds flying about, and the persecution never ended. The very last birds were killed in the wild in 1902, around Indiana and Illinois, that area. And then there were just a few of them living in a zoo at Cincinnati, Ohio, and they slowly died off. And the very last one, Martha, died September 1st, 1914.
What is it about the passenger pigeon's role in the ecosystem, Ben, that has you and your colleagues saying, hey, we should be working to do some gene tweaking, we'll get into that in a bit, and bring them back?
Yeah, so this goes back to the mayhem they would cause in the forest. And while that sounds kind of counterintuitive to a beneficial thing, what we know in forestry science today is that when you go out and you enjoy a walk in the woods and you see beautiful big oak trees and you see thrushes and sparrows and a host of different species that, you know, bring you back to the writing of Thoreau, those species that we think of as so iconic, they're dependent on things like forest fires and storms, these disturbance events that come in and cause damage in the forest so that sunlight can get down to the forest floor and allow new growth to start over. They rely on what we call the forest cycle to go over and over and over again from disturbance and regeneration and succession. And for decades, people thought the primary driver of these disturbance events that are so vital to the biodiversity of eastern United States forests were mainly from storms and fires. But people had kind of forgotten about the passenger pigeon and all of this. And these flocks of billions of birds would come into the forest, overcrowd on branches, break branches down, break entire trees down from their weight, and eventually finally settle into a, you know, nice stable perches. And then as they ate the food over a few days, they built up a whole lot of guano, which, if we're being blunt, is bird crap, several inches deep on the forest floor, like a blanket. And that snuffed out everything on the forest floor, much like a fire would clear out the vegetation of a forest floor. But unlike a fire or a storm, you know, this is more like a tornado dropping fertilizer on the forest. So that would break down. And over the coming years, all we have are these anecdotes that wherever these passenger pigeons roosted or nested for a few weeks at a time would be the greenest patch of forest or the most rich future farmland. And that's our basic value proposition for the idea.
Steve, you're part of the Wisconsin element of this project. What got you involved in this notion of bringing back the passenger pigeon and finding places for them here in Wisconsin?
I think the oak savanna research that a group of us in Wisconsin and Illinois started working on in 1985, where we were looking at oak decline. You know, Dr. Alan Haney at UW-Stevens Point and a whole host of folks from the Morton Arboretum and other organizations around the region really took that on, starting in 1985 and looking at what was becoming of the oak ecosystem. Ben gave me a call when, Ben, I think you were working on your PhD?
Oh, my master's. I do not have a PhD.
You've mastered and more than PhD'd your way into passenger pigeon knowledge. But so I got a call from Ben asking if I recall, Ben, if what we learned about oak systems might be applicable to what he was learning about passenger pigeons. And I said, you know, the big question I've had all my life working with oaks is, you know, what role did passenger pigeons play in moving oak systems around, in structuring oak systems? They had to have been what's now recognized as a keystone species with the, you know, the ecological engineering they did with what Ben's provided on this call. So that's what's gotten me intrigued.
And that's really kind of what dawned this research project that Steve is now helping head in Wisconsin, where we're hoping to engage with local landowners whose land may have actually once been host to a nesting site of passenger pigeons. And if anyone in Wisconsin has a tree in their yard that is over 150 years old, I guarantee that tree had passenger pigeons in its branches at one point in time. And that's a direct connection to that past. And we want to start using that connection to learn more and possibly create an experiment where we could actually figure out if what we hypothesize about this important role in the forest is correct and accurate, and how significant it actually will be to the future of forests.
We are talking about an effort to bring back the extinct passenger pigeon. We've got Steve Applebaum with us with the Applied Ecological Institute here in Wisconsin, and Ben Novak from the group Revive and Restore. All right, I want to talk about the how here a little bit. Let's start with the Wisconsin element here, Steve, and what Ben was mentioning about finding roosting places. So once we bring back the passenger pigeon, tall order, we'll get to that in a minute. What are you doing to find places for them to roost?
What we and several other individuals have done is we've taken the reported and recorded nesting colony locations and myriad records of observations of roosts, and we've mapped that. A group of us. So now we have. I think some of the records go back to the 1650s or 1660s, and we've got the patch of, you know, the polygon, the 10 mile by 40 mile forest up near Merrimack, where there was a passenger pigeon colony in 1888, or the huge colony in 1871 that I can't remember how many square miles in size it was.
850 square miles.
Thank you, Ben.
Wisconsin was home to the largest nesting record in history.
So what we've done is mapped those locations, and we are beginning a process of reaching out to owners of land to ask those landowners or tell them in some cases that we believe that they have trees on their land that predated the nesting, and wondering if it would be possible to visit those older trees and visit the soil beneath those older trees and see if there's a chemical signature of the presence of all that guano that Ben mentioned. That would have most certainly been associated with a nesting colony and even a roosting colony.
All right, Ben, I've left this hanging now. The key ingredient here is the passenger pigeon itself. Without digging too deep into genetic science, how do we bring them back?
So, you know, keeping it simple, the idea is that we can sequence their DNA from the specimens you find in museums, and there are several in museums in Wisconsin and university collections that people can probably go out and see. And the idea is that if we can figure out the differences in their DNA that are responsible for their unique traits, the things that made passenger pigeons flock in these dense, large flocks, that made them hypersocial, that made them have this kind of behavior that created these forest disturbances, then we can then use modern gene editing technology and take a living relative and change its DNA to start to match that of the extinct passenger pigeon. Then we take the cells that we're doing that manipulation in, put those in a surrogate mom, put those in a surrogate dad. And then when that mom and dad breed, hopefully from the egg that hatches, we get something that starts to look and behave like the historic passenger pigeon.
Steve, one objection that I've heard to different proposals to restore extinct species is It's been over 100 years since passenger pigeons now. Our Wisconsin ecosystems are different systems in some ways. Are we disrupting the new equilibrium if we bring back this species that was, you know, so common 150 years ago?
Well, that's a core question that Ben and I and University of Wisconsin and other team members are asking. And we're trying to go about assessing how one might answer that question. So, you know, breaking the question down, we're asking fundamentally, are the oak and the beech forests that supported or are able to support passenger pigeons still in existence? So the acreages, the food yields, you know, they ate a lot of acorns and beech nuts and berries and so forth. Is there an adequate supply available? And where is that located? And who owns those forests? And you know, what is the willingness to participate at a public level, not at a private ownership level at this point? You know, what's the opportunity? What are the obstacles? And then the more fundamental grounding question is, you know, what will they do to the existing ecosystems, which you've so rightly identified as not being the same and perhaps not even be available in the same quantity, you know, acres and so forth. So those are the core questions that ecologically we're trying to understand at this time.
Ben, supposing this goes ahead, what would be a timeline? When might we be able to look up and see that guano falling toward us from the sky?
Well, it's probably a long time. Experimentally, we're hoping to throw some guano from the sky on a patch of forest as early as spring next year.
Wow.
By doing an experiment.
Okay.
to see how, you know, basically recreate that role of the passenger pigeon and study how it's going to affect everything from the microbiome and biochemistry of the soil to the growth of the trees to the regrowth of different vegetation and the colonization of different insects and how things like even deer and other species use that patch of forest after it's been disturbed and coated with guano. But that future of pigeons doing that for us, that's not coming for a while. And that's because, of course, we have to try to recreate the bird first. And these are all new technologies that are being developed, technologies that will help other species of birds and endangered species along the way. We're developing a host of different tools, not just for this, but for many other things. But it takes time. We believe we can probably start recreating the bird between 2029 and 2032. So hopefully at some point in time in the 2030s, we have a flock of birds living in an aviary that is starting to look and behave like historic passenger pigeons. And that's where the real conservation work begins, similar to how peregrine falcons were restored to the eastern forests, or California condors were restored to the west, or whooping cranes in the central United States. People have to breed those birds in these aviaries, condition them to get back out into the wild, and then produce enough of them to form sustaining flocks in the wild. And that can take decades.
We'll leave it there. Ben, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Steve, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, and very exciting to put Wisconsin on the forefront of this thinking.
Ben Novak is lead scientist for the nonprofit Revive and Restore, leading the Passenger Pigeon Project, and Steve Applebaum is founder and chairman of the Applied Ecological Institute.
Hey, it's pumpkin season. Whether you're carving them or you're cooking them, we want to know what's in store for your pumpkins this year.
Let us know at 888-642-0232 or email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Coming up later this week, we'll hear from Wisconsin cookbook author. There's an awesome pumpkin dessert recipe we'll check out and share online.
And Rob, did you finally make that pumpkin soup you've been talking about?
Finally did it last night. It came out really good. Do you have any pumpkin cooking or carving in store, Kate?
Well, well, and, you know, doing a little carving here and there, nothing fancy, but it's those seeds, the pumpkin seed roasting. That's where I really get into it.
And we've got a pumpkin out front. We're letting the squirrels carve it for us this year. You could share your October pumpkin plans, fancy carving, cooking, you name it. Call 888-642-0232 or email wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.